From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox in for Farai Chidea. Senators John McCain and Hillary Clinton both claimed their second big wins in the presidential race. McCain was victorious in South Carolina's Republican primary Saturday, coming out on top in the state where he was slaughtered during his first bid for the White House back in 2000. With strong support from both Latinos and women overall, Clinton took the Nevada caucuses by 51%, and Mitt Romney quietly nabbed his third primary season win in Nevada. Here to help us sort it all out is Ron Elving. He is NPR's senior Washington editor. Hello, Ron.
Good to be with you, Tony.
Let's start talking about Nevada first. After the big boost that Barack Obama received from the Culinary Union endorsement and still didn't win, does that qualify as an upset for Hillary?
It's hard to call it an upset when she was up by 20-some points just a month earlier. This was going to be a state that was very easy for her, and then in the end it turned out to be quite a battle, almost to a draw. The Culinary Workers Union, the SEIU there in Las Vegas, both went with Obama, but as it turned out, they weren't really able to deliver all of their workers. In the exit polls, Hillary Clinton splits the union household vote with Obama right down the middle.
Latino voters overwhelmingly supported her. What does that portend as the campaigns head south and west, where Latinos are in larger number?
The preference of the Latinos for Hillary Clinton in Nevada was one reason why Obama was not able to fully capitalize on those union endorsements, because many of the workers in those unions are Latino. And so far, Obama has not closed the sale with them. That could be a major factor, as you suggest in your question. It could really hurt him, for example, in Florida. It could hurt him in Texas and California. California is part of the February 5th huge tsunami Tuesday of primaries, and it's one where he would dearly like to represent and perhaps win first place. So that lack of connection to Latino voters, that right now stands out as the second biggest problem for Obama. The first one, overall, is that he isn't doing well enough among people who are not African American and make less than $50,000 a year.
On the Republican side, Mitt Romney won in Nevada and John McCain won in South Carolina. Now, with two major wins under his belt, John McCain seems to be grabbing momentum. Is he, and is Romney as well? Because he's now got three primary season wins, the Nevada caucus, Wyoming caucus, and the Michigan primary with Florida looming.
I think a lot of people on the Republican side do think this is becoming a two-man race between John McCain and Mitt Romney for the reasons that you've just said. They do both seem to have competing momentum, and they have quite different assets at this point. Mitt Romney has the enormous advantage of being, at this point, self-financing. He can put as much money into it as he needs. John McCain has to raise his money. But we don't want to count out Mike Huckabee, the former governor of Arkansas. We don't want to count out Rudy Giuliani, the former mayor of New York. Those two are also competing now in Florida, and with just a few days left to their Saturday event there in Florida, we just have a week left to their competition there on January 29th in Florida. That is the first place we've seen all four of the leading Republican candidates compete flat out, where they're really all in the state all week long, running ads on television, really giving it all they've got. After Florida, we'll know if we have a Republican frontrunner.
Let's talk a little bit more about the South, Ron. This is not only John McCain's second big win, but South Carolina was the first voting contest in the South, and it was a state, as we said, that he was trounced in 8 years ago. How significant is winning the first Southern primary?
I think without it, John McCain would be struggling to be at the top in Florida, and he would have a hard time holding on to his small but new lead in the national polls among Republicans. So it was enormous for him, not only to excise those ghosts from 2000, but also to win the primary that, ever since 1980, has been won by every Republican who went on to his party's nomination. That's critical. It shows that he is back up and running among Republicans, not just among independents that he pulls over across the aisle.
To take a longer view of the role that the South is going to play, I'm thinking now particularly about the old Southern strategy, heading through the Southern primaries, is race for either party in the long run going to be a factor, and how much so?
It's always a factor. I don't expect it to be a large factor on the Republican side. But on the Democratic side, really the only question is whether it's going to be the predominant factor. Clearly it's going to matter. It's been made to matter not only by the presence of the most viable candidate, who is an African American that we've seen in either party, but also because the Clinton campaign has made something of an issue of it after the New Hampshire primary. And as a result, when we have the debate tonight with the Congressional Black Caucus as one of the sponsors, and when the questions are asked again and again on Martin Luther King Day, how important is it that you are an African-American candidate? How important are black people to your campaign? This is going to be pushing Obama in the direction of becoming more of a racial candidate, more of a Jesse Jackson kind of candidate, and he's going to want to resist that so as to maintain his campaign of transcending race.
It looks, and we have about 30 seconds left, Ron, that with regard to race, in a large way, Bill Clinton is becoming a factor, isn't he?
Bill Clinton has sometimes been described as the first black American president because he had such a strong connection with the community. That's going to be called into some test, I think, at this point, because he has taken it upon himself to be the attacker for the Clinton campaign, to bring race into the campaign in some respects. And I think that Obama has now said he's going to actively resist that and call the former president out on exactly that issue.
As always, Ron, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Tony.
We've been speaking with NPR's senior Washington editor, Ron Elving. He spoke with us from Washington, D.C. And Myrtle Beach is making history today. This is the first year the South Carolina city is observing Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, and John Edwards are paying homage in remembrance of civil rights leaders throughout the state. Then the top three Democratic candidates will end the day squaring off in a debate sponsored by the Congressional Black Caucus Institute and CNN. For more on tonight's debate and other election insight, we are joined now by House Majority Whip James Clyburn. He represents South Carolina and is the highest-ranking African-American in Congress. Congressman, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
You have said repeatedly, sir, that you have no plans to make an endorsement of any candidate. As the race heats up, are you still holding to that position? And if so, why are you staying neutral?
Well, I am still holding to that position, and it was because, or it is because, last year when we were trying to get South Carolina as the state in the South that would be best suited to be allowed into this pre-primary window, I was asked repeatedly whether or not I would stay out of the contest so that we could have a real good, viable contest. And so I agreed to stay out of it, and I even promised the local Democratic Party that needed this primary to help with its rebuilding efforts that that I would stay out of it. And so I'm keeping that promise so that we could have a real good contest.
A lot has been written about the split that is occurring between black Democratic voters over their support for Obama or for Clinton. Is this a good thing because of the passion that's been aroused in the black electorate, or does it weaken black voting power?
Oh, I don't think there's a rift at all. I think that African Americans are very proud of the way Obama has acquitted himself in this contest. Remember, Jesse Jackson has run for president, so has Al Sharpton, and we know that those were more crusades than campaigns. Obama is now running a full-fledged, very creditable campaign, and African Americans are proud of that. Women are very proud of what has occurred with Hillary Clinton. This is the first time that we've had a woman in position to be possibly be the president of the United States. And so women are proud. They should be proud of that. So why should we deny that same emotion to African Americans who, like women, have been left out of the process for a long, long time?
Well, along that line, Congressman, there seems to be more of an independent spirit among black voters in terms of their not being swayed by the endorsements of others, especially the black clergy. Do you also get that sense, and to what do you attribute that independence?
Yes, I do get that, and I attribute it to maturity. Remember, when I was growing up, the only independent institutions that existed in the African-American community happened to have been the church. So ministers and undertakers have been relatively inoculated or insulated from the system. So as young African-Americans mature, move into the mainstream of our economic parts of our society, that's why we all made the sacrifices we made during the 60s so that the Obamas can, in fact, exist one day. And seem like we have gotten to that day.
We talked earlier about the fact that the CBC debate is tonight. What issues do you expect to hear at that debate? And what issues do you would you like to hear discussed tonight?
Well, I expect for them to deal with the economy. The economy has come front and center in this overall discussion. There are people who feel that we are really at an economic crossroads in this country. And so that ought to be front and center. But, you know, I am hopeful that we will be asking these candidates what they plan to do about other things like the high incarceration rate of African Americans. Something has to be done to address that issue right away, because what we're doing, we're seeing a whole race of people seem to be hurtling toward destruction, if not annihilation. And so I would hope that that issue gets dealt with in this debate tonight.
One last question, Congressman, going back to the race. What is your sense of the role that race is going to play in the presidential contest going forward from South Carolina? And to follow that, how practical is the old Southern strategy that the Democratic Party has used in the past in an effort to win the South?
Well, the Southern strategy was taken to a different level by the Republican Party, where they have actually used race. The South Carolina Republican Party, for instance, used the Confederate battle flag to build participation in its primaries. I think that going forward from here, having an Obama on the race, having a woman in the race, having the first native-born South Carolinian in this race, we'll be able to look at the results in South Carolina. And if you were to take those results by regions, you will be able to determine exactly how race played, if anything, in this campaign, and be able to prepare yourself for the other contests going forward.
Congressman Clyburn, thank you very much, sir.
Thank you so much for having me.
We have been speaking with House Majority Whip James Clyburn. He spoke with us from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. This is News in Notes. I'm Tony Cox. The Nevada caucuses and South Carolina's GOP primary are now behind us. Now it's the Democrats' turn. The candidates have zeroed in on that southern state and the primary coming this Saturday. Roughly half of South Carolina's Democratic voters are black, so many see the primary as a referendum on whether blacks will support Barack Obama. In that regard, the black church is often believed to be in rallying be a key, that is, in rallying the black vote. So how are the candidates courting the church, and who's winning in that race? NPR's Audie Cornish has been on the ground in South Carolina. She joins us now by phone from Myrtle Beach. Audie, nice to talk to you.
Thank you for having me.
You've been in South Carolina for a couple of weeks, and you were at the Zion Baptist Church in Columbia yesterday at an event sponsored by, among others, the Columbia chapter of the NAACP. There was a march to the South Carolina State House attended by Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and John Edwards that started at that very same church just today. Now, we've got a clip from the sermon delivered yesterday by the Reverend Charles Jackson. Let's have a listen.
I never knew how strong and powerful African Americans are in South Carolina. Randolph said the hands that once picked cotton are now in position to pick the next president of the United States.
Tell us more about what you saw there.
Well, one thing that was very clear is just the level of excitement about the race in general. You know, South Carolina is a state that in general elections pass mostly goes to the Republican candidate. So it's not a state that Democrats necessarily expect to win come next November. But this time around, because of the excitement of Barack Obama's candidacy and the excitement around Hillary Clinton's candidacy, and also John Edwards, a native son of the Carolinas, all of a sudden the focus is on the Democratic side of the race, and that's not something folks there are used to. Specifically, African Americans there are now getting a level of interest that is probably a lot higher than they've had in past years. And in talking to people in the church, you really get that sense of history and of precedent, and that sermon, I think, really, really put it into focus about no matter who of these candidates makes it to November, people are so excited that their voice really feels like it's being heard.
Well, you know, you've been to a lot of church events over the past few weeks. Two things. Who are most church leaders supporting between Obama and Clinton? And secondly, do their congregations seem to be following them?
Well, to take the first question, I don't think anybody knows for sure. I mean, back in the fall, Senator Hillary Clinton came out with an endorsement list of something like 80 black ministers and church leaders, and then Obama came out with a list of 100 or so endorsers who were black ministers, and then people fought over whether everyone on Clinton's list was really a minister or not. I mean, it gets to a lot of nitpicking, and I think that gets to the issue that the traditional model is for politicians to court pastors virtually individually to really grow and get that support over time. And I think you're seeing the results of that support with the Clinton campaign. On the other hand, with Barack Obama, he's really done a lot of work, especially last fall, where he reached out not just to churches directly, but he held, like, I think, 40 days of events, faith forums, gospel concerts, reaching out to black Christian radio, and having, in a sense, creating a space politically for the religious, black religious voters to come to him. And so you're seeing a difference in the two campaigns and how they've gone about that. And in terms of does it deliver votes, I think we'll see. One thing about that sermon yesterday is Reverend Jackson did not say he was endorsing any particular candidate. Senator John Edwards was in the audience, and I spoke to more than a dozen voters, and at least half of them were undecided.
You know, we've got the debate tonight, and you are in Myrtle Beach right now. Are you seeing anything, hearing anything about that, and are South Carolinians showing much interest in that particular debate?
Well, the last time the Democrats were here for a debate was last spring. And back then, frankly, Senator Clinton did have the advantage over Senator Obama, even within the black community. She was a few percentage points ahead in some of the polls. This time, they returned to this state, number one, after having gone through some battles in New Hampshire and Iowa and Nevada, and number two, with a very steep change in the polls. Now, Senator Barack Obama is up in some polls by upwards of 10%. Now, I think all of us have learned from New Hampshire that we've been a little bit burnt by polls in the past, but there is a sense that Senator Obama has really not just asserted himself in South Carolina, but really brought people back to him in terms of fighting off the electability question, fighting off the experience question that maybe a lot of voters had in general, but a lot of black voters had expressed last year.
Now, I want to ask you, as I talk to the same question that I put to Congressman Clyburn earlier, and also with Ron Elving, whether or not Bill Clinton himself is becoming a dividing force because of the way that he has aggressively been attacking Obama in defense of his wife on the tinges and fringes of the race issue.
Well, I mean, I don't think there's been any sort of polls done on this yet. And anecdotally, from the stories I've done, I'll say that he's not gaining any points with the approach. Essentially, Senator Hillary Clinton is letting former President Bill Clinton take the lead in terms of attacking Obama. And I think that this is just not gaining anything with the African-American community. After all, I think that this kind of concept of him being, quote-unquote, the first black president was more than tongue-in-cheek and really just spoke to the idea of him having positive relations with the African-American community and good ties. But having good relations is not necessarily the same as being black, and I definitely talked to a lot of folks who said, you know, just because you know us doesn't mean you know us like you think you do, and maybe you're taking your rhetoric a little too far.
Audie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was NPR's Audie Cornish. She joined us by phone from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Now we're going to switch gears a bit and talk about the economy and concerns that we're headed for a recession. Joining us today from South Carolina as well is Bill Spriggs, professor and economics chair at Howard University in Washington, D.C. Bill, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me today.
Last Friday, President Bush called for a $145 billion economic recovery package. It would include rebates to American taxpayers and incentives to businesses in an effort to ward off a possible recession and to give a shot in the arm to the U.S. economy. Now, while the president has sought a more permanent solution to the economic trouble, this temporary approach has, so far at least, been met with cautious optimism on Capitol Hill. The specifics of the president's plan have yet to be worked out with congressional Democrats and Republicans, but the initial sentiment from the Hill was that this was a start, and that was something everyone seemed to agree was necessary to get the economy back on its feet. So, Bill, is this a recessionary plan or a pre-recessionary plan? And does that make a difference in terms of how to stimulate growth?
The problem that Congress has is that we economists date recessions looking backwards. So we actually have to gather information on a couple of quarters of economic activity. And then after the fact, we declare, oh, by the way, you know, last month we were in a recession. So a criticism is that it takes Congress too long to react. I don't know that this is a pre-recessionary plan, and I don't know that there would be a real difference between a plan to recover from a real recession or as we go into one. The issue is you want to maintain consumption and keep people from being overly protective and saving money, because from an individual's perspective, the best thing to do is to save and not spend during a recession. The worst thing for the economy is for everybody to make that decision at the same time.
Now, what is the definition of a recession? That might be helpful for our audience. Is it two consecutive quarters of loss in gross domestic output, or what exactly is it?
That's the sort of general way in which economists define it. There's a little bit more involved than that, but generally speaking, if we have six straight months where the economy is contracting in terms of all the goods and services produced, then we call that a recession.
Now, it's been said, Bill, that when America catches a cold, African Americans get pneumonia. Now, economically speaking, is that still true? And if it is, how much can the rebate and business incentives being proposed help those at the bottom of the financial food chain?
Well, when recessions occur, then what's happening is that companies are no longer generating new jobs. And since we tend to be the last ones in the queue to get a job, it means we're the first ones who show up as being unemployed because we can't get a job. Then the businesses, by needing to contract even further, start firing people. And then we really take it at that point. So, yeah, we do tend to catch it first because we have difficulty getting jobs when they become scarce, and then we tend to be the first ones fired.
Go on.
So, yeah, it is important for African-Americans that a tax rebate be aimed at not just income taxes, which is what President Bush did during 2001, but at all taxpayers, because a big chunk of the federal tax revenue comes from the Social Security tax, the payroll tax that everyone pays. Many African-American households are eligible for the Earned Income Tax Credit, which rebates portions of that payroll tax and means that they don't have a federal income tax liability. So the details matter here. When the president says a rebate to taxpayers, if he means income taxpayers, he's cheating all of those Americans who pay payroll tax but don't have an income tax liability.
Here's the question I was going to ask you as a follow-up to that. In fact, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke and other economists have indicated that it's the poor and the working poor whose spending habits will spur the economy back to health if they're given cash, as the president's plan calls for. So how does that work? Is it the reverse of Ronald Reagan's old trickle-down theory?
If you really want the economy to grow, it's like growing a rose bush. You water from the roots. And yes, it is the reverse of Ronald Reagan. If you water a rose bush from the top, then you get black spot and fungus growing on the rose bush. It won't grow. You got to water the roots. So, yes, this is the reverse of what Ronald Reagan tried to preach to people for 20 years. And as we saw, all you get is income inequality growing. The plant will make it, but you get income inequality. If you grow it from the bottom, then everybody benefits.
Can you compare this proposal, the president's proposal, to the last time we faced a recession? I believe that was at the beginning of the decade, and what was done about it at that time?
Well, he had tax cuts as his number one priority to get out of the recession that came his first year in office. And those tax cuts included not only help to those who were low income, but not very low income. He was aiming at sort of middle class, and then he put in an extra bit for upper income people that kicked in the second year and the third year, and he now wants to make permanent, which had nothing to do with the economic recovery and everything to do with the deficit that we had at the federal level and that we're still trying to recover from. So he put in an economic package on top of the stimulus package. he missed the people at the bottom. And because of that, this recovery was not beneficial to people who are poor. People who are poor during this so-called recovery actually became poorer. And we saw a rise in poverty, even though the economy started to recover around 2002.
Some economists are saying that compared to other decades, our unemployment growth and the inflation numbers aren't so bad. What's your take on that?
This is the worst labor market since Herbert Hoover. No president in the history of the United States has done worse than George W. Bush in terms of labor growth. And the big question we're going to have coming out of what may be another recession under his leadership is where we will get the job growth. Of the 10 highest-paying industries in the United States during this so-called recovery, 8 of those 10 industries were losing jobs during the recovery, including in furniture manufacturing and in appliance manufacturing, the two sectors you think would have benefited from the housing boom that took place, since, of course, new homes need furniture and need appliances. So this is going to be a very difficult recovery coming out of what we're in right now, because we have not generated the jobs typical of most expansions.
Is labor what drives the engine of the economy?
Well, labor drives the engine because people have to have the income to spend, and it comes from getting jobs. And if you don't generate the jobs, they don't have the income. And we have to see wage growth among the people who are working. So that's what makes this path that we've been on the last 6 years very difficult. The way people made it was they went into debt. And now we're having a crisis because they took on too much debt, and they're starting to foreclose on homes and get behind on their credit cards.
Looking at the economy overall, the condition that it is currently in, what do you think happens if no plan is approved pretty soon?
Well, it will be very dangerous if we don't get a plan in place very soon, because we need to try and shore up the confidence of the American consumer, get them believing that the government understands what's happening, and get them confident enough to spend.
Is it already too late, as some people on Wall Street are suggesting, that we should have done something already?
No, I don't think it's too late. I don't think it's too late at all. I think that now is the time. The government actually can act quicker than Wall Street believes. If there can be a quick consensus, this is the season when people are preparing their tax returns, and it would be very easy to put extra money into those tax returns and get people money by March or April.
Final thing is this. Do you think, as we sit here today, that the Fed, the Federal Reserve, and Ben Bernanke, and the White House and Congress are on the same page on this?
Well, I think the pressure that they're getting from Wall Street, and clearly the criticism has stung Bernanke from Wall Street, there is enough pressure to get everybody on the same page.
Well, it'll be interesting to see as it develops. You're hopeful that a plan will be approved within the next, month?
I'm hopeful that in the next month a plan will be approved.
I appreciate you coming on. Thank you very much, Bill.
Thank you.
Bill Spriggs is a professor and chair of economics at Howard University in Washington, D.C. He spoke with us from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. No matter who you're voting for in November, you've got to admit the White House race is red hot right now. And in Black America, well, it's been quite a while since Black folks have been this energized about a presidential campaign. On today's Bloggers Roundtable, we're going to talk about Blacks and the political passion. We're also going to take a look at how that passion has affected the current presidential campaigning in the South, where blacks make up a large percentage of the electorate. Plus, a golf magazine editor is fired after the picture of a noose is featured on the cover. Joining me now is Amber Nicole. She runs the blog Nicola.com. Also, we have John McCann of the blog Book of John and Ed Brown. His blog is called Dark Star Spouts Off. Amber, John, Ed, everybody, welcome.
Hello. What's up, guys?
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with this one. Let's talk about all the excitement. I want to know if you guys have been feeling it and seeing it and hearing it that's been bubbling up, especially among our folks around this White House race. I mean, it's everywhere I go. Folks are having some intense discussions, some straight-up fights over their favorite candidates. Ed, you're in Maryland, not too far from Baltimore. Are you feeling this there?
I'm starting to feel it, yes, definitely. You know, in my own little circle, people are talking about it more, and definitely on the internet, people are talking about it more, and they're putting their 2 cents worth in.
But it's not just the opinion. You know, everybody has an opinion. We all know that. But it seems as if, you know, if you have the wrong opinion, you're in for a problem with people of color on this race. Am I right?
You're right about that. I've written that a few times. It seems to me that if you are against Obama, people are saying that you're a race traitor, which I think is unfair. If you're for Obama, then some people are saying, well, the only reason why you're for him is because you're black. You know, there's no win here. You can't be for Obama just because you agree with his ideas. You can't be against Obama because you disagree with his ideas. It's just one way or the other, and it's really sad in the way I'm thinking.
Let's go across the country to Seattle. Amber, what are you seeing up there?
You know, it's interesting because one of the things that always cracks me up about the black community is that we tend to toe the Democrat Party line. And so when we have conversations with each other, I tend to roll with a pretty passionate group of people. And a lot of times people will always make the assumption that you're going to vote for a Democrat. So it always becomes a conversation about, is it Hillary or is it Obama? And, you know, the reality is that there's a lot more across the political spectrum, I think, that needs to be looked at right now. But, you know, I've had knockout, drag down, very loud conversations. In fact, very recently, this past weekend, I was down in Atlanta visiting some friends. And, you know, I mean, we almost got escorted out of the restaurant because we were so loud and passionate about the topic.
Really? You know, John, you're in North Carolina. We're talking about the South. And it would seem that outside of the urban centers of America, and I'm talking now about New York, Chicago, places like that, that the South is really where the rubber hits the road as far as this issue, the passion that black people have about this campaign, where it really is palpable.
Well, you know, black people have, I guess the stereotype is that we don't show up and vote. And if black folks don't show up and vote this time with Obama being in the election, then I don't think we're ever going to vote. I wrote a column recently, and I was speaking favorably of Obama, not endorsing him. But somebody read that column and assumed, because you see my little black face in the paper and me writing favorably about Obama, that it was my endorsement. So I understand what Brother Ed is talking about. But the thing that I do like about this election is that the black celebrities, they don't seem to have the burden to say that, hey, because I am a black celebrity, a black person in the public eye, that I have to back Obama. Because you look at the brothers Johnson, you know, Magic Johnson, Johnson and Bob Johnson, and you know, here they are throwing their love to Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. Now, some might question Bob Johnson with the creator of BET and all those booty shaker movies as not really being a black man or doing a disservice to black folks, but give it up to him for stepping out there and saying, hey, I'm feeling Hillary right now.
You know, how much do you think any of this is either A, generational, or B, regional, or 3, gender-based with regard to how folks have become just so hyped up over this? Amber, let me ask you first.
Well, I mean, I think being young myself, I'm 26, I think it's definitely generational to some extent. You know, I mean, my generation, and as a lot of people tend to be pretty disgruntled with the way things are currently going in this country. So if that's not reason enough alone to sort of rally people behind, you know, getting excited, I don't know what is. But to be honest, I don't know if I'm entirely sold on how passionate black people are right now about voting. I think there's a lot of talk right now, but I don't know. I'm not really sold on it yet.
Well, they're passionate about talking about it. There's
there
no question. Whether that translates.
We'll talk now.
Yeah, that's true. Well, let me move the conversation a little more specific with regard to the election, particularly in the South. There is a term that I believe all three of you are familiar with, and I know that many people in our audience are as well. It's called the Southern Strategy, and it's been employed to varying degrees of success by both the Democratic and Republican parties historically. And what it basically boils down to, and I want to get your take on it, is infusing race in such a way as to make it an advantage to your party. Are you seeing, Ed, signs of the Southern Strategy emerging so far?
Oh, I definitely am. I think that the Clinton campaign has been using a light form of it. They haven't done something like a Sister Soldier or a Willie Horton, but the comments made by, say, Hillary concerning Martin Luther King, she's too smart. Her campaign is too smart. You don't make those sort of comments, you know, off the top of your head without thinking about it. The reference to Obama's drug use and saying, well, he hasn't been vetted, he might be, you know, or alluding that he may be a drug dealer. That type of thing doesn't come out of nowhere. And to a degree, I actually think that maybe it's worked.
Do you?
Yeah, because I think what they're doing is that, you know, Obama's campaign, and I'm not supporting him or whatever, as a matter of fact, I'm independent, but, you know, his campaign has been to rise above race and to try to stick to the issues. And
let me interrupt you to ask this, and I want Amber to chime in. How realistic is that, really, 21st century America, to rise above race? Can it be done?
Go ahead. I'll let you go.
Oh, I'm sorry, Amber. Go. I'm sorry. Go.
Oh, no. I was just going to say, I think it's somewhat unrealistic. I think that, the reality is that I think there are some deep-seated issues, not among just white America, quote unquote, but also in Black America. I think there is a lot of conditioning in us to distrust even the fact that someone who is African American could be a strong leader. I've talked to Black friends and so on and so forth who it is an issue for them, and they wouldn't ever come out and say it, but just naturally they're not inclined to vote for Obama just because, you know, in their minds I think that they've been conditioned to think that he couldn't possibly be a good leader. And this is by in no means an endorsement for Obama on my part.
I understand. John, what do you say?
I think it is possible for us. Well, I'll speak for myself. For me, this is not a race issue. You know, I don't like Obama because he's Black. I don't dislike Hillary because she's white. At some point we got to just sit down and say, hey, listen, what are the issues? Now, Obama is doing a great job of that and not injecting race into the discussion. The problem I'm having is I can't really say that I would say that it's intentional that the Clinton camp is putting these little embers out there to spark a flame. Y'all help me with that one.
Ed.
I think it's intentional. I mean, you know, the drug dealer comment, again, the drug use and alluding that he's a drug dealer, the comment about Martin Luther King, to me, from what I've read about it, it just seemed out of context and, you know, really unneeded. And then, you know, it goes back to Andrew Young, who basically told Obama, hey, little boy, it's not your time. Sit back and wait.
Well, he didn't say it in those words, but you're right.
He didn't say it.
He said he was too young. He thought he was too young.
Right. But that was my interpretation of it. And that's when I really started to get fired up because I'm thinking, hey, you know, here's a young Black man. He's actually around my age, standing up and, you know, saying, hey, let's do this. It's my mm-hmm. turn. And that's where the generational thing comes into play.
Let me ask this. Do either of you feel that in any way Barack Obama has had to pander in order to avoid having the race card used against him in a negative way in terms of his campaigning?
On that one, I'm not too sure. But he used to get some play when he would criticize, you know, the things that are going on wrong in the Black community. And I've noticed that hasn't been spoken about in some time. You know, now it's the split. And I'm troubled by this, really.
Ed, go ahead.
Well, you know, I see it a lot like the whole Tiger Woods situation that we're going to discuss in a minute. I mean, we can't sit here and make this man Barack Obama talk about race and make him and assume that he's got, you know, that we can't make him say what we just because we're saying something about race. You know, if he's not feeling that as far as saying, hey, I need to make race an issue, just like the whole Tiger Woods thing, let the man run his race.
How do you feel, Amber,
with that?
How do you see it?
I mean, I actually think the media plays a big part into this. I think that there is an attempt, and, you know, I don't want to make any accusations about the Clinton camp, but I think they're very smart and they're very strategic and they know what they're doing. But I do think that there is a sort of a strategy even among media outlets to sort of bring in race as a divisive factor, because people know that mm-hmm. when you talk about race, it's going to divide people. It's just a fact. It's one of those things that in the workplace, it doesn't matter where you are in a restaurant, if you mm-hmm. bring it up and you start talking about it, it becomes a dividing line. So I think that, you know, I don't care what generation it is. I think that as long as race is part of the conversation, it's going to be very divisive when it comes to talking about this political campaign.
Final question about Barack Obama for today, at least. Analytically looking at this, who do you think or how well do you think Barack Obama will do through the Southern primaries, which begin for the Democrats on Saturday in South Carolina? Ed, you first.
He's going to get blown out. Nevada showed it. He's going to get blown out.
Really? With yes. almost 50% of the vote in South Carolina still, he's going to get blown out?
South Carolina may be different, but when he goes to the rest of the states, the, you know, the black vote percentage isn't that high. Mm-hmm. He's going to get blown out.
What do you say, Ed?
That was it.
Oh, Ed, I apologize. John, what do you say?
Well, you know, if you guys remember that poll a while back where black folks were saying that, hey, we're going to vote for Hillary because we don't think Obama can win. Now, Obama has a strong showing in Iowa. I have to say I was on the bandwagon, not necessarily endorsing him, but on the bandwagon saying, hey, this guy might be the next president of the United States. Then Hillary makes a comeback. I look for Hillary to come out of South Carolina.
Amber.
Yeah, I don't know. I think the one area that I worried about the most for Obama was the South, to be quite honest, because I think there are a lot of issues down there, and I don't think that they're necessarily ready to elect a black man as president, quite honestly.
All right, well, let's switch topics. The Noose is once again back in the news. The magazine Golf Week printed a picture of a big one on the cover of a recent issue. The caption was, "Caught in a noose." It referenced the Golf Channel television anchor who made an on-air comment in jest about lynching Tiger Woods as the only way for his competitors to stop him. She was suspended for a couple of weeks, and there was a big furor. And then right after that, out comes this magazine. Now, the magazine's editor was fired, and the publication apologized for what it called an error in judgment, although the article inside was meant to explore the controversy. John, it didn't help that there were no blacks on the editorial staff when the decision to run that news was being made. My question, though, is whether that would have made a difference in the end. What do you think?
I don't know. Let me just speak personally. I don't know if having black folks in the newsroom, you know, making a decision about the cover, but what was so bad about the cover? I mean, apart the magazine's and the media's job is to cover what's in the news. So if this news is so bad, then you're telling me that it's okay to describe the rugged noose around somebody's neck and it's scratching and making you bleed and all this kind of stuff, but I can't show you a picture of it. I mean, if that's the case, we can't watch Roots. We can't do a lot of things that conject or inject certain or invoke certain images. So I think it was a bad move to fire this editor.
What do you think, Ed?
That's a good take. I think it was the right thing to do, even though what, you know, was just said has to make me think some more. But I think it was the right thing to do because you could have put that on there in other ways and gotten a point across. I think the original comment that was made by the sportscaster actually in context wasn't that bad. It wasn't the most appropriate thing to say, but it wasn't bad. I think mm-hmm. the news on the magazine cover took it to another level.
Well, Amber, you know, certain words and symbols are lightning rods. You know, the flag, stars and bars, for example, the N-word. Do you think the noose is right up there with them?
You know, I do. I think that, and it's funny that I'm taking this position because I was one of the people who didn't have a problem with, what's his name, the shock jock, you know,
Don Imus.
Exactly. I didn't have an issue with that. It's interesting that I'm taking this stance, but I do think that it is one of those symbols. I think if you were to throw in something like the swastika or, you know, anything like that on the cover of a magazine in the same similar context, I think that, you know, the Jewish community, for example, would be outraged. And I just think it was a dumb move on their part. I think that in light of the controversy that had already been, you know, started as a result of the comments themselves, I just don't think that it was a wise decision. And I do actually, in this instance, support the fact that this person was asked to leave.
Well, let me come back to you with a follow-up as we bring the conversation to a close. We have less than a minute left. Pushing the envelope is what the media does these days in order to grab attention and audience. But when it goes too far, as Golf Week felt that this did, what do you think the aftermath should be? What is appropriate, Amber? Firing one person, hiring more people of color, staying out of controversy? What?
I think it's political. I think they fire someone to make themselves look good. I don't, you know, necessarily know that you can change what root issues are, and root issues are something that's probably a much bigger conversation that we don't have time to have today.
Well, I appreciate all of you coming on. I have been speaking with Amber Nicole. She runs the blog Nicola.com. She joined me from member station KUOW in Seattle, Washington. Also, John McCann of the blog Book of John. He joined me from member station WUNC in Durham, North Carolina. And Ed Brown. His blog is called Dark Star Spouts Off. He was online from the studios at the Baltimore Sun. Amber, John, Ed, everybody, thank you for coming on.
Thanks for
having me. You're welcome.
That's our show for today. Thanks for being with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. No spaces, just nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, a look back at tonight's Democratic debate in South Carolina.
Rock, jazz, urban, classical, world, folk. Discover old and new favorites in a variety of genres at NPR's music website. That's at npr.org/music. Upon a broken guitar.